From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. June 28th marked the 10th anniversary of the U.S.-backed coup in Honduras that ousted democratically elected President Manuel Zelaya and unleashed a new chapter of violence in the Central American nation. The coup in Honduras was backed by the Obama administration and especially by then State Secretary Hillary Clinton. Now, a decade later, Hondurans join waves of Central American refugees in fleeing the drug and gang violence that is plaguing their nation. Despite the incessant discussion of immigration in the U.S., few are connecting the dots between the U.S. support of a devastating coup and how its aftermath has generated an exodus northward. My guest is Matt Ginsberg-Jekyll. He's a member of the Honduras Solidarity Network. Welcome to the program, Matt.
Thank you so much for having me, Sonali.
So your organization has put out a statement marking this 10th anniversary. But aside from an op-ed by Representative Jan Schakowsky in The Hill, I have seen almost no mention of what happened 10 years ago in the media. It's sort of stunning, the silence. A 10th anniversary is usually sort of a significant thing. So can you take us back then, 10 years ago, and explain to those among our audience who might not have followed it back then, what happened in Honduras?
So yeah, I just want to start by saying it is quite shocking, although unfortunately in some ways not unsurprising, that there's been such a media blackout regarding what's been going on for the last 10 years and continues to take place in Honduras. And that's because it's taking place in a country that's been a very close U.S. ally historically. And that sort of is the starting point for understanding what happened 10 years ago. Honduras had always been considered a quote-unquote banana republic, the backyard of U.S. policy in the region. It was a place that was a staging ground, some might remember, in the 80s for the counterinsurgency wars in Nicaragua and El Salvador that the U.S. was funding, financing, training, providing training for, et cetera. And so when in the mid-2000s, a president began to show the first signs of any political independence from U.S. control, this is Manuel Zelaya, by doing very simple measures, really, doubling the minimum wage, beginning to try to retake some control over natural resources within Honduras, allying Honduras with the emerging left bloc in Latin America as opposed to with the United States, it was considered intolerable because Honduras was such an important geopolitical piece of U.S. policy in the region. And so on June 28, 2009, a U.S.-trained general, Romeo Vasquez Velasquez, who was trained at the U.S. School of the Americas in Georgia, led a mission that broke down the door of then-President Manuel Zelaya's house and kidnapped him in his pajamas, flew him first to, and this is another part that gets left out of the news stories about this, first to a U.S.-controlled military base in Honduras, and then on from there to Costa Rica, where he was exiled, creating the first coup d'etat in Latin America in the 21st century.
And then we had the presidency of Juan Orlando Hernandez, who has been a stalwart U.S. ally. How did that come about, and what has his rule meant for Hondurans?
So democracy was never restored following the coup. The military has essentially been in control while running a sort of show of an apparent facade of democracy on the surface. So there's been fraudulent election and corruption scandal after fraudulent election and corruption scandal. The most recent iteration of that is the installation into power of the current dictator of Honduras, Juan Orlando Hernandez, who was the president of the Congress for a time. He was very much involved in the coup back in the day. While he was the president of Congress, he worked to staff the Supreme Court in order to lay the groundwork for changing the law that prohibited, changing the interpretation of the Constitution, which is very clear, saying that there's not any situation under which re-election of a standing president is allowed. And he's now been in, he's the first Honduran president in the modern era to serve a second term. I was in Honduras during the so-called elections that led to that second term and was eyewitness to the fraud, widespread fraud, fraud that was condemned, by the way, by the EU, by the Organization of American States, by everybody who was there observing it. The system went down for several days at a point at which the overwhelming majority of the votes cast had gone for the opposition alliance against the dictatorship. And when it came back on, those results were reversed and the military took to the streets to brutally repress people who protested that blatant fraud. 40 people were killed in the aftermath of that. And the killing and repression has continued ever since then, as has the resistance by the Honduran people in the streets up to the present day.
What is the link between Juan Orlando Hernandez's rule and the gang violence that has been plaguing Honduras, like we are seeing in other Central American nations, that has in particular generated such a flow of refugees northward?
So a couple of things. One, it's a criminal regime, and I'm not saying that in a way that's in any way an exaggeration. His brother, the president's brother, is in jail in Miami, accused by the DEA of being not just somebody who took a bribe, but being a top-level drug trafficker. His party has been found to have embezzled millions of dollars from the public health care system. It's just a complete disrespect for the rule of law. By the top executive in the country. And so at one level, you have a criminal enterprise essentially ruling the country. At another level, then, that disrespect for the law translates into the rest of society having just no respect for the remaining civil institutions, which are seen and are to be completely corrupt. And then on top of that, you have a situation in which Honduras has become an important transit point for drugs moving their way north to the United States. We have the ongoing failure of the war on drugs. And then on top of all of that, you might think with a criminal enterprise that has shown no respect for democracy or the rule of law in charge of the country, that a country like the U.S., which has always, at least at a discursive level, claimed to be in favor of democracy, might distance itself. Quite the opposite has taken place. There has been a doubling down of support for this regime. There's continued flowing of U.S. tax dollars to fund his military police, et cetera. And so it's led to a situation of essentially spiraling and uncontrolled violence. And that's why the vast majority of people that we're seeing in the caravans heading north and the vast majority of the people that are in these cages at the border when we talk about this migration crisis are Hondurans fleeing this regime.
And in addition to the crime and the lack of accountability of criminals, you also have rampant poverty, right? How did the Hernandez regime reverse Zelaya's anti-poverty measures?
That's right. So these two things are deeply connected. The reason that people are in the streets is not just because of the rupture of democracy. It's because they were taking the first steps that they had seen towards beginning to alleviate a situation that has left Honduras as the second poorest country in the Western Hemisphere for decades now, with some of the measures that you referred to that Zelaya had implemented. And that coup was on behalf of corporate interests, U.S., Canadian, and other transnational corporate interests that basically see Honduras as a place to pillage for natural resources, gold, bananas, palm oil, etc. And so there's a strong commitment amongst the regime to privatization of healthcare, to privatization of education, a strong commitment to reversing what had begun to take place under Zelaya, which was the granting of land to landless peasant groups that had occupied pieces of land that were not being used by the small handful of landowners that own the vast majority of wealth in the country. All of that's being reversed and at an aggressive pace and with the brute use of military force to try to stop any resistance to that reversal.
And I understand that this past spring saw a massive uprising by doctors and students and nurses and teachers against privatization measures. But you didn't hear anything about those movements here in the United States or about the U.S. government supporting those movements like they have tried to support, say, in a country like Venezuela, right?
That's exactly right. If what has been taking place in Honduras daily, even a fraction of it were to be taking place in Venezuela and Cuba and any other regime not friendly to the United States, you would be seeing it 24/7 on CNN, on the BBC, hearing about it in the BBC, seeing it in the Wall Street Journal, etc. Instead, it's almost complete media blackout because these are our quote-unquote friends who are taking place. These are doctors, these are teachers, these are landless people's organizations that are in the streets saying, we want some basic minimal social safety net in the midst of this madness, and we're not going to allow these services to be handed over to corporations and to entities that have pillaged them. It's important to remember that one of the big scandals that led to such a stinging defeat to Juan Orlando Hernandez in those elections before they shut down the system and reversed the results was the corruption scandal where his party was found to have sold through fake pharmaceutical companies pills filled with flour to the national health system and taken all of the money from those fake sales and put it into his reelection campaign.
They
have pillaged the healthcare system. 3,000 people are estimated to have died from thinking that they were taking real medicine. Instead, were taking pills full of flour. And those deaths are in the hands of this regime. And those deaths are ultimately in the hands of the United States of America that continues to stand by this regime.
Now, one of the important markers of the past 10 years of violence was the death of Berta Cáceres, a very well-known environmental activist. Tell us a little bit about how her death was symbolic of everything that we've seen in Honduras. And have her murderers ever received justice?
No, they have not. Berta was a close personal friend. She was somebody that I had the privilege of knowing very well. Berta was a visionary. Berta was the one that was the voice calling for a way forward, a way out of the madness. Berta was the one who organized hundreds of indigenous communities to fight to save this planet in the face of devastating attacks on it that are leading to global warming that could wipe all of us out eventually. Berta was the one who was able to unite social forces across lines of race, gender, etc. Berta was the one who was able to get the union folks in the same room with the feminists, in the same room with the indigenous communities. Berta was a visionary. She was somebody that was pointing a way forward, not just for Honduras, but for this world. And on March 2nd, 2016, Berta's life was stolen from us by bullets that were fired by people that were linked to the Honduran armed forces. At the time, the most immediate struggle that she was engaged in was accompanying the community of Rio Blanco to try to stop the building of a mega dam that threatened to wipe out and continues to threaten to wipe out their ancestral lands, stop them from being able to cultivate the land and the sustenance they depend on, and also interrupt the flow of a river of tremendous spiritual significance to them. The company that is building that dam, which has heavy financing from transnational capital, is a group called DESA. And the highest executives in DESA have been found to be directly linked to her assassination, to the plotting of it, to the financing of it. They involved members of the active members, majors, and colonels in the Honduran military in the efforts to stake out her home and assassinate her that night. And while they have found some low-level people that were the actual people that pulled the triggers guilty of the crime, and they have accused one DESA executive, nobody has touched the family and the oligarchy that everybody knows is behind this, who are the top DESA shareholders, that is the Atala family. They're being protected by the regime of Juan Orlando Hernandez. And so no, justice has not been served. However, the saying that is in the streets of Honduras is Berta didn't die, she multiplied. And it's very literally true. And one way literally true, because there are a whole generation of babies being born that are in the indigenous communities of Western Honduras being named Berta Isabel.
After oh, wow. Berta. So her namesakes are multiplying.
And beyond the namesake, more importantly, are the millions of people in the streets in Honduras who continue to raise her name, who continue to raise her voice, who continue to raise her struggle up, and the people around the world, because Berta was somebody who was an internationalist in the deepest way you can imagine. Berta is very much present in the streets today during this 10-year anniversary of the coup. It was Berta who was the leading force, the leading voice of resistance against the coup d'etat. And there was a very striking quote she said about the coup that I think gets to the heart of it. She said that the coup d'etat was a continuation of the U.S. policy of annexation towards every country in this continent. And it's a reflection of the U.S.'s sense that they have lost control in the region. And that is absolutely right. Those words are as true today about the backing of Juan Orlando Hernandez and the U.S. standing by him during the electoral fraud as they were 10 years ago about the U.S.'s complicity in the coup. Berta was somebody who was a critic of both parties of the United States, both the Hillary Clintons and Barack Obamas back when they were supporting the coup, as well as the rightward turn in U.S. politics, recognizing that both of them, unfortunately, have had a remarkable consistency in policy towards Latin America, which is a policy of plunder, privatization, and complete disregard for human rights.
So just a day before the 10th anniversary of the U.S.-backed coup in Honduras, former Vice President Joe Biden was part of the first Democratic debate, and the issue of Honduras and his regime's support, his administration's support for that coup, did not come up at all, even when issues of immigration were raised. That's a big pity, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is incredibly angering. It's infuriating to see people feigning support for children that are in cages at the border and refusing to talk about their own complicity in supporting the exact policies that led to those children and their families having to flee in the first place. It is dollars for that dictator that are leading to these children being in those cages, and nobody has a right to talk, especially not Joe Biden, who was part of the administration that was complicit in ensuring the success of the coup d'etat in Honduras, about any sympathy with people at the border if they don't express any sense of repentance and a new way forward with regards to the policies that are leading those people to be there in the first place.
So I mentioned Representative Jan Schakowsky's op-ed in The Hill that she published. She's a Illinois representative, and she wrote a piece entitled 10 Years After the Coup in Honduras, the U.S. Must Reevaluate Its Position. And she urged her colleagues in the House to co-sponsor H.R. 1945, the Berta Cáceres Human Rights in Honduras Act. Is this an act that your organization, the Honduras Solidarity Network, supports? And what is in this act?
Absolutely. We've been pushing it very strongly in conjunction with our partners within the Honduran social movements, in particular Berta's organization, COPIN, which is led by her daughter. The act states very simply that we should not be sending dollars to dictators. It says that while impunity and human rights violations continue in Honduras, U.S. tax dollars should not be funding the slaughter. U.S. tax dollars should not be funding this criminal regime. It's common sense. The president's brother is in jail as a narco trafficker, and yet we're continuing to fund him. The president's forces are shooting people dead in the streets and forcing people to flee, and yet we're continuing to fund him. How can they say, I live in Chicago, a city where we closed half our city's mental health clinics, where we closed 50 schools. How can we say we don't have money for schools, we don't have money for healthcare, and yet somehow we have money to fund the criminal enterprise and pay for their bullets to kill people like Berta? It needs to stop. It's common sense. It's something that I think really could reach across both aisles. And that's exactly why, unfortunately, the media has had such a blackout around this, is because they realize that it would not be popular for people to find out that the money that they work hard for and pay a portion of in their taxes is going to fund slaughter rather than funding human need.
And again, we have these double standards. I want to sort of bring back the analogy we were discussing around Venezuela. Al Jazeera reported the day before the 10th anniversary of the coup that 90% of public schools in Honduras are facing an infrastructure crisis. Hospitals are falling apart from lack of funding and turning away patients. If we just replace Juan Orlando Hernandez in Honduras with Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela, you would see so much coverage of this in the U.S. media, and you would see the U.S. denounce, what this particular Central American nation is doing. And of course, there's silence.
Yeah, absolutely. There's complete silence because there's complete complicity. And that's the sad reality of it. I am hopeful, however, with the bill picking up more momentum and support, that we can leverage it as an opportunity to really re-examine U.S. policy towards Latin America. But it's going to require people to really push hard, and always has required people to push hard. This is a set of policies that are incredibly harmful to Hondurans, but also incredibly harmful to the United States itself and to people everywhere. And so I think we need to focus as much attention as possible on what it would mean to have a humane turn in U.S. foreign policy.
How many representatives in the House, as far as you know, are supporting the act that we were mentioning?
So this is actually the third time that has been introduced. I don't have the most up-to-date numbers on me. I believe it's close to 100 co-sponsors right now that are on it. And We're particularly hopeful that with the emergence of figures like Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, like Ilhan Omar, who herself is a refugee, who are paying close attention to these issues, that we can begin to have, in addition to the voices that have been supporting this act, like Jan Schakowsky, like Representative Hank Johnson, Keith Ellison, when he was in the Congress, was a huge champion of it, that we can begin to get some more movement and momentum on it. At the end of the day, the most effective thing we can do in solidarity with the Honduran people is stop funding the regime of Juan Orlando Hernandez, and that's exactly what this act says. It's a common sense act, and it's something that I think that if we were to get it to a vote, we could get through.
And then finally, in terms of the immigration crisis here in the United States, as we mentioned, this issue of the U.S. role in the coup and the support for this regime is going unmentioned. What would you like to see happen, setting aside Congress, even the immigrant rights community that has been working hard and all of the lawyers that have been working hard to try to, you know, undermine the Trump administration's cruel, you know, murderous policies of locking children up in concentration camps? Would you like to see a greater linkage between U.S. policies in nations like Central America and the migration crisis?
Yes, absolutely. You know, and it's something that I've been working very carefully on as well. I think that we oftentimes end up reacting to the immediate crisis in front of us, understandably so, because the conditions that those children living in are unfathomable and need to be responded to, and at a very real, immediate, material level. The support work that lawyers and other agencies, as well as folks in the immigrant rights movement, are doing for those cases is invaluable. However, I think that also we need to seize the moment and make links to what the root causes are. There has been movement towards that. We had a summit that took place in Tijuana, a meeting of a number of representatives of the caravan, the first big one that had left in October, as well as members of the immigrant rights community, solidarity communities, and activists from Honduras, Mexico, and the U.S. And I think the big thing that came out of that is an understanding that if we prioritize really listening to the voices of folks in the caravans themselves, this story will naturally emerge. And I think sometimes we can be too quickly to jump on the element of the story that the media is carrying and to focus on that. But really, if you listen to folks themselves that are coming on these caravans, they're talking about, there's a reason that the entire time they were marching through Mexico, they were chanting Fuera Ho, which means the initials of the dictator are J-O-H, pronounced Ho in Spanish, and Fuera means out with. So they were saying out with the dictator, out with the dictator, as they're marching through Mexico. And yet, unfortunately, even amongst many of the activist communities, that message was not echoed. And so I think it's a really simple thing. A commitment of solidarity is a commitment about lifting up the voices that are not being listened to. And right now, those voices are speaking very clearly, and it's our responsibility to include that message in our messaging.
Well, give out a website, Matt, where people can find out more about the Honduras Solidarity Network.
HondurasSolidarity.org is our website. It is a network of many different organizations within there. My particular organization is called La Voz de los de Abajo. We're one of the founding members, and our blog for ongoing news from the struggle in Honduras is HondurasResists.blogspot.
And we'll post a link to both of those sites on our website. Thank you so much, Matt.
Thank you so much.
My guest has been Matt Ginsberg-Jekyll. He's a member of the Honduras Solidarity Network. We've been discussing the 10th anniversary of the U.S.-backed coup in Honduras, June 28th of this year. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our video channel on Vimeo, and find our audio podcast on iTunes and now Spotify.